Welcome to A New Prescription, where we explore modern healthcare, cutting-edge medical research and technology, and the complexities of healthcare politics. Join us as we provide insights and solutions to help you navigate the American healthcare system. Welcome back to A New Prescription. I'm your co-host, Andrew Zwelling, and with me is Dr. Leonard Zwelling. Dad, say hello to our people.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. We have a great show today. I hope you'll enjoy it.
You see what I'm wearing today? I'm wearing my Duke.
You're wearing your Duke stuff, getting ready for Friday.
And health is in the middle of this topic. Cooper Flagg's leg. We'll see how his ankle holds up.
That's going to be interesting. Having had that injury, he's coming back a lot faster than I did. He's also much younger than I was when I had that injury. So maybe that's not unexpected.
Yeah, well, I think he's going to come back strong, and I think we're going to win.
I think it's a long road, as you know. You got to win six consecutive games, and you got to start with the first one, and that's on Friday. So let's see what happens.
Go blue.
Absolutely.
Moving on to our main topic, it's been almost 5 years since the pandemic and the coronavirus entered the shores of America, sending us all into lockdown mode. The institution that was at the center of this event was the Center for Disease Control, or the CDC, that falls under the executive branch. Since the pandemic, the CDC has come under great pressure from the United States citizens, as they have lost trust and faith in the information coming out of this institution. Before the pandemic, 88% of Americans believed the science coming out of the CDC. That number has plummeted to 62%. And now with bird flu knocking on our door to becoming the next pandemic, a resurgence of a measles outbreak, and the denial of vaccines within the country, it is now more important than ever for our CDC to gain back trust with the United States. So what is the CDC's mission? What do the inner workings of this institution look like? And what are some of the consequences for drawing down some of the CDC's resources in the event that we do get another pandemic? To discuss this with us all and more is Dr. Stephen C. Redd. Dr. Redd is a retired U.S. physician and Rear Admiral with the United States Health Service and an Assistant Surgeon General. With over 30 years of public health and executive leadership experience, Dr. Redd served as the Director of the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response at the Center for Disease Control. Previously, he was the director of the CDC's Influenza Coordinating Unit, where he served as the incident commander for the H1N1 pandemic in 2009 and in 2010. Dr. Redd, thank you so much for joining us. We're really happy to have you here.
It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to the discussion today.
My first question is really around the CDC is, when did it start and what was its original mission when it started?
So the history of CDC began really before CDC with the malaria control in war areas effort during World War II. The troops that were being in basic training, a lot of them came to the southeastern part of the United States where malaria was endemic. So the federal government established a program to determine how much malaria there was in the southeastern United States and to try to eliminate it to protect the troops in basic training. After the war, there was a lot of discussion about whether this activity should be continued or not. And in 1946, this effort that was had been based in Atlanta was renamed, one of many renamings, but first became known as CDC. At that time, it was the Communicable Diseases Center and focused just on infectious diseases. And it's kind of interesting that that first little period, some of the things that this precursor to CDC were some of those efforts they were devoted to have been sustained through the history of CDC. Training, it's a big part of CDC's mission, and working with state health departments. And then there are other things that are very different. Initially, epidemiology was not really a core component of that malaria and control in war areas. So there were entomologists, there were engineers, sanitarians, laboratory people, but epidemiology wasn't really a big part of the effort initially.
So, and you, I think you sort of alluded to why the CDC is in Atlanta. That's where it's where its roots were, is in Atlanta. And it's still, is it associated with Emory in any specific way?
There's a lot of cross-fertilization. I think that's actually grown over the years. A lot of people who had their careers at CDC then went to work at Emory. The School of Public Health is across the street. There's not that much. I guess there is actually some of the junior people that go to school at Emory will enter CDC. When I went to medical school at Emory, really wasn't quite so much the case. But with the School of Public Health and being right next door, there's a good bit of interaction.
Let's hope that the role of the CDC now is not looking at malaria as a spot problem. What is the biggest areas that CDC focuses on right now?
Well, actually, malaria still is a focus of CDC overseas. So a long time ago, I worked in malaria, and we were very proud of that. Most of that work now is not in the U.S., although there are cases of malaria among travelers in particular. But I would say the biggest areas right now are, and this is really reflected in the programs, the centers now that are the key expertise areas. But infectious disease is a big area, separate area for vaccination, a separate area for other infectious diseases, and really kind of the diseases of the underserved, HIV, TB, sexually transmitted diseases. And there's a lot of work in chronic diseases, environmental health. Some things that were added to CDC kind of over the years, occupational health. So it's really a broad portfolio of health-related issues.
Is it the public health center of the United States, essentially?
It really is. And in fact, overseas there are national institutes of public health, and CDC is really one of those in the United States. Really growing from that initial seed of malaria control in the Southeast.
Where does it fit into the government? To whom does it report? And who reports up to the head of the CDC?
So CDC is part of the federal government. And I think that years ago when I started, I sort of knew that, but I didn't really understand where we were on the branches of the government. But CDC reports to Health and Human Services. One of the biggest departments in the federal government, in the executive department. So the CDC director reports to the Secretary of HHS. There is a big role that Congress plays, though, because that's where the money comes from. So the CDC is funded through appropriations that Congress makes. And a lot of what CDC is allowed to do or encouraged to do relates to those appropriations.
The appropriations go directly to CDC? They are earmarked for CDC?
They are earmarked for CDC. They go through Health and Human Services and then are distributed the same way NIH and the FDA, the same way their money comes.
One of the big things that people look to the CDC is to communicate about some of these communicable diseases. And there was a publication, MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Is that still in existence? What does it do? I mean, I remember it in medical school hearing a lot about MMWR.
Yeah, I think the history of the MMWR is a little bit like CDC, that there are predecessor publications, but it was formally transferred to CDC in 1961 and became really the sort of the CDC journal, that the articles that are published in the MMWR are related to public health, either with CDC authors or state health department authors. There is an internal review process, and there, up until January of this year, it had been published every week from that 1961 date till the present. When the new administration came in, they, as we've read in the news, halted all external communication. And one of the things that was halted was the publication of the MMWR. So it was in suspended animation for 2 weeks. and then began with a limited number of publications. So it is being published now, but with kind of a limited, I think we'll see how broad the issues that are addressed are. Up to now, it's been relatively restricted.
Let's change the subject just a bit to one of the hot button issues we want to cover, which is vaccines. Let's start with the obvious question. How many vaccines should an American child get before the age of 10? It seems like it's a pretty big number.
The way that it works is that there's a committee of external experts that CDC convenes called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. That committee meets three times a year, makes recommendations to the CDC director, which the CDC director then either accepts, rejects, or changes, and the CDC director makes recommendations for vaccination. In the early 1980s, because of the failure to eliminate measles from the United States, there were efforts in each state to set a list of vaccines that were required for school entry. So every state has a list of vaccines for school entry, and the actual number varies by state. I think in North Carolina, it's 8 vaccines, and in Georgia, it's 9. Some of those vaccines are combination vaccines, so it's more antigen. So there's measles, mumps, and rubella that's a single shot. Same thing with diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. And different vaccines require different number of doses to be up to date. For measles, mumps, rubella, it's 2 vaccinations. For diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, it's 5 vaccinations. So it's kind of a complicated question. It depends on the state, and it depends on whether you're counting injections or number of components of each of the vaccines.
But it's a fairly significant number. And one of the things we've heard a lot about with Bobby Kennedy's appointment to HHS is whether or not there are going to be different recommendations coming out of the CDC. And one of the things we sort of want to address is what are the misconceptions regarding vaccines? Some people are obviously with the measles epidemic, maybe not an epidemic yet, but certainly in South Texas it is. There are almost of the people who get measles haven't been vaccinated. And the number of people getting measles depends a lot about having a lot of people vaccinated, something called herd immunity. Can you discuss that as it pertains to measles right now, and what are we facing in some of these states?
Measles is a highly transmissible disease, maybe the most transmissible infectious disease there is. So that if a single person with measles is put into a proximity of people who aren't vaccinated, many of those people will contract measles, more so than flu or chickenpox or pretty much any of the other vaccine preventable diseases. So it's very transmissible. It's also a serious disease that the number of people who die is relatively high, 1 or 2 per 1,000 cases. So it's been a real success up to now to have controlled measles to the extent the U.S. has, that the disease has not had ongoing transmission in the United States since the year 2000. And even before that, transmission had been interrupted, had been documented to have stopped within the United States. And then other cases come from overseas, and there's endemic transmission is reintroduced. So it's very important to vaccinate against measles. It's also a very effective vaccine. So you have a very transmissible disease and a very effective vaccine. A single dose is over 90% effective, but because measles is so transmissible, a second dose is necessary to get to that level higher than 95%. That can mean that the chances of coming into contact with somebody who's susceptible is low enough that transmission won't be sustained. And the situation in Texas right now is that there's so many unvaccinated people that if there's a person who contracts measles and exposes that other person, that person is going to get measles, and it just goes on and on. So measles vaccination has been an incredible success in the United States and globally too, actually, that hundreds of thousands of children are not dying because of the measles vaccination program worldwide.
Are the cuts to USAID going to change that, do you think?
Well, I think the question is where the money will come from. And AID has been a supporter of immunization through WHO and direct funding and through UNICEF in particular. So I think there's big questions about what's going to happen. I think with everything in public health right now, there are significant questions. The misconception, I think the kind of general misconception about vaccinations is that the side effects are worse than the disease or the risk of disease. And that is really the mission of the FDA and their review process and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices is to assess the benefits and the risk and make a recommendation about what's the right course to improve health. So I think there's a misconception that these side effects are very common and very severe, which just isn't true. There are side effects to all vaccinations. They tend to be the ones that are frequent tend to not be serious. And there are occasions where a serious side effect will occur, but that's generally so rare that the benefit of vaccination outweighs that risk. I think in the case of measles in particular, there's a question of autism that is based, really, I think there's maybe been some underlying questions all along, but in the late 90s, there was a study from the UK, a physician named Andrew Wakefield, who published a paper that in the paper, there was a claim that 8 of 12 children with autism had evidence of measles vaccine virus in their gastrointestinal tract. And that really created a big problem in the UK, but really globally, that there's this question of, is this a legitimate observation? Subsequently, that study has been rejected or retracted and also found to be basically invalid, that it just almost everything you could imagine that was done from faking the results that were used to make that association to falsehoods in the paper about informed consent and whether a peer review, there was a institutional review board review to conflicts of interest related to being funded by lawyers who had anti-vaccination sentiments to a business to diagnose this condition, which probably doesn't really, what doesn't exist. Just, I mean, almost anything you could imagine that was inappropriate. And so anyway, that study is not true, but it kind of, the memory of it kind of lingers on.
But there may be a new study.
Well, there have been several studies after that that have disproved this purported association. And I think it's true that there's more autism than there used to be. It's an important scientific question, putting effort to proving again that vaccination is not the cause of it is not going to help find out. It's not going to lead to any improvements in autism or prevent any cases of autism. So I think it's really misguided, and that effort should be directed elsewhere.
Right. Andrew?
Yeah, no, what do you attribute to the rise in skepticism? It sounds like there's a link between false data that's been, pervasive within the communities. What else do you attribute to this large skepticism in vaccines within the United States population?
Yeah, I think it's part of a general trend of distrusting experts. And I think, so that was happening all through the 2000s and 2010s. And I think that really was exacerbated by the COVID vaccination program and all of the sort of conspiracy theories that were boiling. So I think that it's part of a larger trend that got a lot worse after COVID. I think that the modern communication, social media, I think that's played a role where it allows people, kind of conspiracy theorists, to aggregate and perpetuate their beliefs more effectively than in the past. And I think the response from the kind of the, I don't know, the establishment has really been, hasn't been that effective. I think this is like a, it's like a war in a new zone of weapons. And, you know, how to counteract that effectively has been challenging.
What are the data about the COVID vaccine? I've heard a lot of people on both sides. If there are two sides to this, it's that the vaccines work versus the vaccines don't. And what's the truth?
Well, I think that we're going to know more as time goes on. I think it is really amazing that such an effective vaccine was developed so quickly. And the clinical trials that were done in the fall of 2020 and quickly yielded results were really a triumph of public-private partnership and the scientific methods. So the vaccines are highly effective. They're not perfect.
How did that work? You know, in the trial, they followed people after some got vaccines and some didn't, as to the incidence of them contracting COVID later on?
Exactly. The trials were given, you know, you get the vaccine or you get a placebo, and then you're followed over time, and the group that got the placebo were much more likely to get COVID. The initial trials, at least, were not measuring infection, but they were measuring infection severe enough to require to have symptoms. So it was really symptomatic COVID. And so even after those trials, there are questions about how effective is it preventing infection? How effective is it in preventing hospitalization or death? The initial trials didn't study that. And I remember talking to people in January and February, and the vaccine was so effective, there's this assumption that it prevented infection and that it would be long lasting. And unfortunately, those two things didn't turn out to be true, that, or at least over time, the vaccine's effectiveness in preventing infection wanes. And it seems that it prevents hospitalization and death for a longer period of time, but the duration of immunity isn't what you'd want. It's not anything like measles vaccine or chickenpox vaccine, which, for measles, when you get two doses, that's all you need. You get two doses as a child, the chances of you having waning immunity 30 or 40 years ago are very, very low. To maybe not at all. You know, just doesn't happen.
Is COVID more like flu then?
A little bit more like influenza vaccine, right? I think it's more effective than influenza vaccine. It's sort of to make a general statement.
And when you're talking about a COVID vaccine, I assume you're talking about the mRNA vaccine, one of the
right. And also, well, the subunit vaccines also are highly effective, but also similar to flu vaccines, there's a waning of immunity, and so the result of that is that you need to be vaccinated, repeatedly, and similar to flu. The virus changes, and making sure that you've got a good match between the virus that makes the vaccine and the virus that's circulating is important. With regard to adverse events, I know myself, when I got my second dose, the day after that, I just didn't feel well. I'm sort of achy, and I think that's quite common. More severe adverse events are not they are quite uncommon, but they do exist. And so young men have a risk for cardiomyopathy, basically an inflammation of the heart muscle that's a serious thing. Almost all the cases there's recovery, but it's not it's just something that is a serious side effect. And I think it's important to make sure that people know that there is that side effect. It's, to me, that is, finding of that adverse event is evidence that there's not more serious things that are being hidden in some way. So I think
it's effective vaccine. What's the metric of that effectiveness?
It's really what we were talking about before, that in a clinical trial, people who get the vaccine are less likely to have an illness associated with infection with COVID than people who did not get the vaccine. And there are other ways to, besides clinical trials, in looking at people that are hospitalized for COVID now, they're much more likely to not have received a vaccine than people who have received a vaccine. So there, now that that vaccine is in wide-scale use, there's a way to assess its effectiveness in a real-world setting, apart from a clinical trial where everything is very tightly controlled.
Well, I can tell you, Dr. Red, when the vaccine first came out, I rolled up my sleeve right away and asked them to shoot me up. And I'm still doing the same to today. I get the 2-for-1 flu and COVID shot. So we've talked a little bit about what the vaccine does. What about on more of like a preventative front in terms of CDC's history and what happens when the pandemic hits? Are there were there plans in place? Are there currently plans in place? My understanding is that actually the previous administration, Obama administration, had a plan of a rollout of any pandemic that came out, then it got scrapped. Can you give us a little bit of insight onto what we have as a preventive measures and plans in place that the CDC has?
Well, one of the big missions of CDC is to be prepared for unexpected infectious disease, particularly infectious disease outbreaks and pandemics if they're, you know, worldwide. There was a lot of work on a plan for pandemic influenza beginning in the Bush administration in 2005, 2006. So there was a really vigorous effort to get ready for an influenza pandemic. Some people will remember H5N1 was an avian influenza virus that was circulating in Southeast Asia, spread all the way west to Nigeria, mostly affecting birds, but also affecting people with some human-to-human transmission, very high mortality rate. This stimulated the Bush administration to put a major effort into getting ready for an influenza pandemic. The HHS secretary actually visited every state to tell the governor to get ready. You know, this could be coming, you need to be ready. So that planning process was continued after the H1N1 pandemic. Again, about 15 years ago, there was an influenza pandemic, not anything like the COVID pandemic. So there was work, there was ongoing work for influenza. There was not a specific COVID plan. And the value of that influenza plan really was to get people ready to know what kind of decisions would need to be made. The plan could not answer every question, but it could get people ready to the process and know who it is you're going to have to be working with. And I think that plan was used not in a formal way where people took the plan out and said, here on page 3, here's what we're supposed to do. But the process at CDC was similar to what it would have been for an influenza pandemic. It's a little bit less clear how, in those early days in particular, what was happening at the kind of the higher levels of government. But I think the thing that really failed in that is that the decision-making process was really, it needed to be a lot cleaner and understandable. Like, here's a problem that we knew we were gonna face. Here are the things that we think are important. You know, to do this, take this course of action, that course of action. That didn't really happen in the way that it should have early on. There was a lot of focus on things that were important but would have limited consequence. Flights from China to the U.S., huge effort to make sure that people were quarantined effectively. Cruise ships in Southeast Asia, you know, lots and lots of time and effort of really senior people devoted to that instead of, you know, this is likely going to come to the U.S. Well, how are we going to deal with this? A couple of really, I think, key errors early on kind of took us off course. And one of the most important ones was the diagnostic test that CDC developed that was probably contaminated, didn't work. It was a complicated test and didn't work in the state health departments. And, you know, I think that is the kind of thing that can happen. The part of that that was the real problem was that it took a month to correct that, and it was really a critical month in February of 2020. That what happened during that month is that very few people got tested. That testing was really focused on places where people from China would be entering the U.S., and the whole transmission in Europe and importation in the U.S. was really missed for a long time. And so New York in particular had lots and lots of cases before they were recognized because of the limited testing and sort of hoarding the resources of testing to people that were thought to be in places where most of the disease was, which was really wrong.
What could they have done, for example, if they had the testing?
It could have done a lot of testing. Really, one thing would have been just to broaden who was eligible to be testing, to who was able to be tested, and testing looking back, you'd say, well, could have tested in the northeastern United States where people from Europe were returning, and that could have led to some control measures that by the time the disease was recognized in New York, things like case identification and isolation and quarantine weren't possible because of the scale. So we kind of skipped over the way that it was planned to control the outbreak. We thought we were at step A, and it turned out we were on step F when we recognized all the things that we hadn't recognized up to then.
Well, the obvious question is, do we now, given that what we learned from COVID, hopefully learned from COVID, do we have a plan in place now, should a new epidemic occur or pandemic occur, that would allow us to be far better prepared for it and not have hospital ICUs overwhelmed? And people, certainly in New York, they were stacking bodies in trucks, and we don't want to see that again. Is there a plan to make sure that does not happen again?
So I wish I could be more reassuring than I'm going to be able to be.
We don't really need reassurance here.
I don't really know the answer to the question. I will say that a global level, I think the country is kind of at a place where we want to just forget what happened for the last 5 years and, go from the present forward. I would say that the Mpox outbreak and the avian influenza right now, the responses right now are not all that reassuring that we've learned the lessons of the past. I think that, honestly, I think the political leadership is not giving a lot of cause for optimism or for confidence that the response is going to be strong either. I sort of think of it as the way the United States was after World War I, that it was just like, we want to forget that and we're just going to move into the future, compared with World War II, when it said, we can't have this happen again. All these international institutions were formed, and there was a real recognition of the need to put in place systems to not let the world get the way that it did after World War I.
The obvious question I think that people will have is, when have I had sufficient numbers of COVID shots? Do I need one every year? And if I have had COVID, do I need any more shots?
I think this is going to be like flu, where you are going to need more shots. In fact, the current recommendation is, if you're 65 or older, you need to get two of the current shots. So not just one shot the way that flu vaccine is, but every 6 months, at least right now, that's what the recommendation is. So I think that is going to be a recommendation to continue to get COVID vaccination on out into the future until there's a vaccine that can prevent transmission.
So these vaccines kick up our immune system, but do it relatively transiently compared to the vaccines for measles, mumps, and rubella.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. It's much, the immune response to the COVID vaccines is much more like the immune response to flu or to flu vaccines than it is to some of these other vaccines that lead to lifelong, can have lifelong immunity.
So is it the nature of the vaccine that may, in the case of the COVID vaccines, those are often mRNA vaccines, whereas the flu vaccine is not an mRNA vaccine, as far as I know. And yet neither construction is sufficient to give you lifetime immunity.
I think it's more about the virus than it is the vaccine. I think that the virus changes and just by its nature, the immune response that infection with the virus that it generates is not lifelong either. So you can get flu, you know, you probably have more than, you'll be a little bit protected the next year, but after a few years, it's, in terms of infection, you're not that different than, you know, it's, you'll still, you probably will get less severe illness. And I think we're seeing that with COVID too, that everybody's been infected with COVID now, and the illness that people get is not as severe as it was in 2020 for sure.
And what is long COVID all about? Where did that come from? We don't often see that with other diseases like COVID, flu, viral diseases. Why is this so strange and not really totally understood quite yet?
Well, it's true that it's not well understood, and it probably is. It's probably not one thing. It is probably, and I think this is part of what has to be, is being sorted out, is which kind of long COVID do you have? It's likely an immune response from infection gone wrong that then can lead to cardiac problems or neurological problems or respiratory problems, and whether there's a common pathway that leads to each of those, or they're really kind of distinct from each other. You know, until we have a better understanding of that, I think it's going to be hard to have effective treatments. You'll be mixing people together. Maybe there's one type of treatment that helps people with brain fog that doesn't help people with orthostatic hypertension, where their blood pressure drops when they stand up.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the White House and with Doge and Mr. Musk. Has he had any effect on the CDC yet? Is it anticipated he will? And if he does, what does that mean for the American people?
Well, I think he has had a big effect already. In late January, people got notices that they'd been terminated, and it was most of the people who got terminated were early in their careers. There was pushback that was effective, so the big training programs were I guess rescued from that situation. That the Epidemic Intelligence Service, the Laboratory Leadership Service, and the Public Health Associates Program, these are all programs that take junior people out of early in their training, out of school, either public health school, medical school, or college for the associates program. It's really the future of public health is in those people. And those programs were all abolished and then pretty quickly reinstituted.
Was that with a court order, or just did they find money?
It wasn't a court order. I think it was recognition that actually what people were saying was true, that these are really important things, that if we sacrifice them, and I think we've seen this in other places too. There was the thing about the Ebola program in AID that supposedly was we turned it off, then we turned it back on. I don't think things are quite that easy to turn back on, but there still are, you know, somewhere 800 to 1,000 people who have been laid off, who haven't been brought back, as far as I'm aware. And that, I think that's one of the things just about all of what's going on, is this very, there's a lot of confusion and chaos in terms of what's the latest thing. I mean, just with the tariffs, like, are they on, are they off, are they for some things or everything? It just seems to be part of the way the administration is operating.
So how does that uncertainty impact, like, the CDC institutions, whether it's being on again or off again, people are being reinstated? What does that uncertainty do to the CDC?
Well, first of all, it is a morale deflator, apart from the terminations, the work that can be done is being sharply limited as well. That who you can talk to outside of the agency is limited, and CDC really operates. The main work is outside of CDC, so communicating with health departments, with clinicians, with medical societies, and with the public, that holding all of that in really limits CDC, and it also limits what the people who at CDC are able to do, even if they are working. So I think it's really a lot of things have ground to a halt. We can see some of the things kind of percolating through, where the MMWR articles that are being published now. There's a lot of discussion about the process to decide the formulation for the influenza vaccine. It's one of the first steps in that is a convening by the WHO of a committee to review the surveillance data from the world. The U.S. did participate in that meeting. So even though there were meetings canceled within the United States, CDC did participate in that. So there will be a flu vaccine next year. But it is really, I think it kind of adds a layer of, am I allowed to do this? Am I not allowed to do this? Rather than just going ahead and taking an action.
Mm-hmm. And what I mean, if say you were back in the CDC in your current role, what do you think would be limited or by the uncertainty? Are there certain specific actions you think for your job that would be limited?
Well, I didn't even talk about the funding. That's just a huge thing that where I, one of the last places I worked, we had a large grant program to states to be ready for emergencies. And I think there's a question right now as to whether that money is going to go to states. Are they going to have to fire people? Can they do exercises? I mean, it really is just paralyzing to not have that funding and to not be able to communicate with them. And even if you could communicate, I'm not sure what you would say at, not being at the pinnacle to say, here's what's going to happen. So it's really, it's generating a lot of anxiety and purposeless effort.
What about the damage it might do to the public health? I mean, the more the issue is, and the obvious question is bird flu. I mean, let's say for a moment, bird flu does begin to spread and it is shown to be able to be transmitted person to person. Would the CDC really be able to implement even the plan that it has now to fight it?
I think what I would hope would happen when that is recognized is that floodgates of permissions and of funding would be opened, which would be great. We're still losing time right now by not putting in place the plans of, what are you going to do when there's the first outbreak of human-to-human transmission, which I hope people are working on, but it can't be exercised in a big way, the way that it would be if there were the funding that, were available. I think that is the thing that is really kind of staring us in the face right now. I think that just to go to bird flu for a minute, the major effort has got to be on the animal side right now. There are outbreaks in about 1,000 dairy cow herds, hundreds of poultry, both commercial and backyard. I found a number, 90 million birds have been affected or been either culled or had H5N1. So it's a huge problem. And, it doesn't seem like we've got the right formula to control it right now on the agriculture side.
What about the appointment of Robert Kennedy as the head of HHS? He has been known to be a vaccine skeptic, quite controversial figure. He seems to have gone after food additives as his first choice of a target, which we talked about in a previous broadcast as being a pretty wise choice and far less controversial than vaccines might be. But is it anticipated that he might try to change the way vaccines are administered in the country? And if so, what does his appointment as head of HHS mean for the CDC?
So I think we have some evidence from the past that's not reassuring. We have the hearing, which was maybe a little bit reassuring. And then we have some of the statements since he's been in place, which I would say have not been reassuring. The other thing that we know is that the meeting that was scheduled for February for the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices was canceled. Yeah. So that's not ever happened before. I'd say if you sort of weigh everything together, it's not encouraging. I think that the idea that we need to do something to reverse the epidemic of chronic disease, I think that would be great. And think it would be great to work through CDC to implement programs to improve people's health and have better control of hypertension and reduced rates of obesity. That would all be terrific. I think that it's not, you can't really ignore infectious diseases because they're going to be there. And, you know, we've got bird flu, we've got measles, and these are problems that need to be addressed. So I hope that he puts the energy into understanding what the solution is and helps implement that.
Does the CDC operate outside the United States at all, or is it solely a public health service to the people of the United States?
CDC has a big international presence, and it really began with the smallpox program. CDC played a big role in the eradication of smallpox in the 1970s. Right now, there are about 60 countries that have CDC staff working with the ministries of health on lots of different problems, on malaria, on polio eradication efforts. Probably the biggest area is HIV control. A lot of really important successes in getting people identified with HIV and getting them on effective treatment. That's millions of people are alive today that wouldn't be without that program. And it also, that presence also provides an alert system for the U.S. and really for the world. When a problem comes up, there are people on the ground that can go and right away investigate. There was an instance in 2014 when a person with Ebola from West Africa went to Nigeria, and the polio program just instantly changed direction and controlled an outbreak. 14 people were infected, could have been thousands without that quick turnaround and the capability right there on the ground. So having people overseas and having those relationships with the ministries of health and individuals in those ministries of health is really it's a key asset. There's a lot of training that goes on overseas as well to help build local capacity, both laboratory and epidemiology.
Is that being threatened now with the budget cuts?
I think so. I mean, I think that I can't say exactly which programs are being curtailed, but with what's happened with USAID, I don't think those programs are. The HIV program is co-managed. It's a State Department program with AID and CDC having equal roles. So there's going to be a huge gap there. And that'll affect CDC as well. That people are going to have to come back if there's not funding to do that. And really, it's not just the funding, it's really the leadership prioritization of those activities.
Yeah, I think the question is that there's a stripping out of layers of people with great competence at the CDC. Our ability to respond to any threat from outside the country, not to mention ones that start here, it's going to be curtailed. I mean, we could have another epidemic in a heartbeat.
We could. I mean, it's a plane ride away or a mutation away.
And it seems to me like time is a really important factor in all this, that the longer there's something that's not in place and the infection goes on longer, the more deaths that can occur. If we catch it earlier and prevent it earlier, whether it be in outside countries or within here, we can save lives by doing that.
Absolutely. I mean, really, time is a key criterion. And for things overseas, if you can play that sort of forward defense, that if you know what's happening in some part of Africa, that'll be much less likely to be found in the United States if it can be stopped far away.
What's the current thinking now? I know this has evolved over time as to where COVID came from. I mean, the initial story we got was that it came from the wet market in Wuhan. It's a little hard to swallow that the Viral Institute there, which seemed to have an interest in gain-of-function research in virology, didn't have a role in this. And I know they've never admitted it, and the Chinese has not allowed a real good investigation into the samples that were taken early on when people were first getting sick in China. Is that being rectified at all, or are we going to stay in the dark forever about where COVID came from?
I don't think we're going to know where COVID came from unless the Chinese provide more information. There was a great hope after the SARS epidemic in 2003 that was in also from China, that there would be a more openness and transparency. And it seemed like there was an outbreak of a different influenza virus, H7N3, that mostly affected birds but did infect a few humans. And it seemed like we knew more about that than we did SARS in the early days. I think that whether it came from the lab or came from the wet market, I don't think that it was a creation of a bioweapon in Wuhan, but it's not unlikely that there were infections of people working there because the biosecurity was lax. It's equally plausible that animals from Yunnan, from southern China, were in the market and infected people who then went back to the lab. You've seen these intelligence estimates that some of the agencies think it was from the lab and some don't, or some think the evidence isn't strong enough to say it was. The bigger issue is that greater transparency and earlier recognition would be helpful. And how do you encourage that? How can we improve biosecurity practices, which we're working hard on in the United States, but we've got very limited tools to make that happen outside the U.S.
Tell us a little bit about any other kind of research that's going on at the CDC that the public might be interested in, about which it doesn't know very much. Are there other kinds? When I visited the CDC, I learned there was a tobacco program there, actually looking at the epidemiology and the etiology of and what was in tobacco smoke, and that was all in the CDC.
Right.
Are there other programs like that at the CDC?
Well, I think people have, they see things with the efforts. I guess one thing that we were talking a little bit a while back about where does guidance come from? And the things that CDC produces guidance on are pretty far ranging, from the number of minutes you should exercise in a week. That's a CDC guideline, what drugs should you use to treat anthrax from 2001. So there's a real breadth of problems or issues that CDC addresses. And, ideally the level of effort would be commensurate with the magnitude of the problem and the ability to do something about the problem. And so tobacco is a good example of a really big problem with effective intervention, some medical, but a lot of it more on the communication, the kind of public campaigning side. So I think tobacco is a very interesting problem, that it was kind of stalled for a while at a level of really a too high of a level of tobacco use. And then with some of the, probably because of some of the advertising, the rates dropped maybe to like 10 or 12% now, where 20, 15 years ago, maybe 20% of people smoked.
Yes. Okay. Andrew?
Yeah. So, we've covered, the CDC's mission. We've talked about the vaccination prevention, its important role. Now it's being potentially limited in terms of funding and involvement by our government. Are there any last things that you want us to come away with about the CDC, its future, and how we can protect ourselves in the event that another pandemic does occur within the United States?
So I think the most important thing people can do is to make their voices heard through the legislature, and really, I think it seems like not going to have an impact, but I think that congressional staff do read the letters and the communications they get from their voters. And so I think there is a real responsiveness at that level. And so I think telling your congressman that you want CDC to continue to protect the country the way that it has in the past is really valuable. I think that's also true because of what happens in your state. So much money from CDC really goes to state health departments. CDC is a big funder of state health department activities. So it's not just what happens in Atlanta that will be curtailed. There will be things in all the states that won't happen because of that lack of funding. So I think that's the most valuable thing. I think really it's hard to do, but I think keeping track of where things stand is also important, and what are the threats that you need to be thinking about, and what is the status of these different efforts coming from the White House to limit the ability of that kind of clear communication to occur. So I think that's another area to be cognizant of and to be vocal about.
Are there resources that you recommend people look at to be able to see what the current updates are that are accurate and at the forefront?
Yeah, I think in terms of disease, the CDC still has good information on their website, even though it's limited. I think in terms of the news media, don't really have specific advice. I think that it is hard to keep track of because things, you know, it seems like something can be announced in the morning and then by the afternoon it's different and then the next day it's different. But still, I think the tendency for that is to devolve into a sense of inertia and inaction. And I think that's a real danger, that people need to stay on top of what's happening. And you can't look at everything. So I think whatever it is that is most important to you, truly try to keep track of that. And not just keep track of it, but use that information to take action.
Well, Dr. Redd, thank you so much for joining us. We really thoroughly enjoyed learning more about the CDC. I wish I could have known more when the pandemic was going on about how important it was. But thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And we'd love to have you back to talk about advancements in the CDC.
It's my pleasure. And it's great talking with you guys.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. If you have specific questions for Dr. Redd, please DM me at A New Prescription on any of our social pages. You can also see previous episodes on YouTube at A New Prescription YouTube. And remember, your health is the most important thing to you. We'll see you next time.